A decade of discovery. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. A robotic explorer on Mars is celebrating 10 years on the Red Planet. NASA's Curiosity rover launched from Cape Canaveral in 2011 and landed on Mars in August 2012. Its mission is to explore the geology of Mars and determine if the planet ever contained conditions favorable to life in a region called Gale Crater. Despite a decade on the planet, there's no sign of the robot slowing down.
We still have a lot in the tank to keep going, and so when will be the end? We don't quite know. But the really exciting news is that we still have a ton in the tank to keep exploring Gale Crater.
Then, the launch of NASA's Artemis 1 mission is less than 2 weeks away, and the Space Coast is bracing for an influx of spectators.
The tourism folks are also expecting somewhere between at least 100,000 visitors to the Space Coast for this launch.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From 90.7 WMFE News. For the past 10 years, NASA's Curiosity rover has been exploring the geology of Mars, specifically an area called Gale Crater. Curiosity builds upon the scientific and engineering knowledge of previous Red Planet rovers and aims to help us answer key questions about life outside our own planet. So what has Curiosity learned, and what's ahead after a decade of discovery so far? We're joined by Amy Williams, an assistant professor of geology at the University of Florida and a member of the Curiosity rover's science team. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me back. It's always a joy to be on the show.
It's always great to have you back on the show to talk about Mars, especially when we're celebrating 10 years of discovery with the Curiosity rover. As I mentioned, it landed a decade ago. Let's step back 10 years. Why was this rover so different from any others that we sent to Mars?
Really excellent question. So Curiosity was sort of the next generation of Mars rovers. Prior to Curiosity, we had the Mars Exploration Rovers Spirit and Opportunity, which really raised the benchmark for what we could do on Mars with robotic exploration. Even previous to them, Sojourner demonstrated that you could drive a rover on Mars. The Exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity were able to find extensive evidence for water on Mars. And they actually, greatly exceeded their timelines for how long we thought those missions could run. So we, they had 3 month prime missions, and they went for years in one case over a decade. And so with Curiosity, I believe that so the name for it is Mars Science Lab. But I think that MSL originally stood for Mars Smart Lab, because the point was that you could put an entire analytical chemistry suite on a rover and send it to Mars. And the real challenge was getting a vehicle big enough that you could put those instruments on, and then building a landing system that could accommodate such a large vehicle.
Mm-hmm. So the thought process, Amy, was, back then there wasn't this idea that we could immediately get samples back to Earth. So because we didn't have that capability, let's just bring the lab to Mars. That's kind of the biggest difference between these, right? Is that you're bringing a chemistry lab to the surface of Mars, which, as you alluded to, was very difficult, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. If you can't bring the rocks, to our lab, send the lab to Mars. Absolutely. And I think that lessons learned from Curiosity have really fed into future Mars missions and current missions as well, that those lessons learned have been just so integral to designing missions that can address our most fundamental questions about Mars.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, Curiosity has brought a chemistry lab to the surface of Mars. 10 years ago, what was its primary objective? What was it looking for with all that equipment?
So the prime objective and goal for Curiosity was to search for habitable environments on Mars. So an environment where life would want to live if life ever arose on Mars. And so the big things that we tend to look for when you want to find a habitable environment is evidence for water, the presence of carbon, and then an energy source that picture like a microbe, like a bacterium, could use for its metabolism. And so those were sort of the big things that we needed to look for in the given environment to say, yes, this was once habitable in the past.
And what was some of the equipment that was on board that helped kind of uncover that?
So Curiosity has this really fantastic instrument suite that's still functioning today, 10 years later. So we have several camera systems that enable us to take sort of landscape images as well as really up close and personal sort of almost hand lens scale pictures of rocks and soils. We have several chemistry instruments, including the ChemCam, which has the laser. Everyone sort of like envisions this laser shooting out of this rover. We have the SAM instrument, which can detect organic carbon. It can measure the isotopes of a variety of stable isotope systems. It can do a bunch of stuff. And then we have also the ChemIn instrument, which could evaluate the mineralogy of the rocks that we're exploring, as well as other instruments that are able to assess the weather and climate. We have RAD, we have REMS. So we have all of these, this sort of complementary suite that's not just chemistry necessarily, but sort of all the instruments you need to answer that question of, was this environment habitable in the ancient past?
Mm-hmm. And this might be a very difficult question for you to answer, Amy, but what are some of the most interesting or intriguing findings that Curiosity has found over these past 10 years? Can you identify a few?
Can I list this and take up your whole podcast? Yes. If I have to narrow it down, I would say that the fact that we have identified habitable environments in Gale Crater, which is Curiosity's exploration region. Habitable environments, places where life would want to live if life had ever arisen. And not only were they habitable, but they were so over relatively long geologic time periods. We're talking millions to tens of millions of years. And what's so intriguing about Mars is that the time period in which Mars was habitable was very early on and seemingly similar to the time when life arose on Earth. And so that question, it just sticks with us, whether life could have arisen on Mars. And sending Curiosity was that first big step in assessing, is there a way to identify an environment where that life would live? And Curiosity has done it again and again over these past 10 years.
I have to just kind of reiterate how kind of mind-boggling this is. I mean, scientists and engineers put a, you know, vehicle-sized rover on another planet and discovered places that life could once want to have lived in. I mean, that is mind-bogglingly awesome, isn't it?
I think it's one of those things that you hear it and you start to accept it just as fact. And even as a member of the science team, I have to stop myself and think, like, we're doing this on Mars and we're doing it right now. I mean, every day we're doing operations with Curiosity and with the next Mars rover Perseverance. We're doing daily rover operations, asking these questions and not only getting new answers, but of course it always opens the door to additional questions. Our questions are never answered in full only because new questions arise as we learn more and more about the surface of Mars.
You mentioned that Curiosity's, the prequel to Curiosity, these rovers that came before it, far outlasted their anticipated time on the Red Planet. I'm wondering, what limitations are there on Curiosity? What's powering Curiosity and how much time could it have left?
Oh, yes, that's always the $64,000 question, right? So it is, with inflation, is that higher now? I think it might be. So the MER rovers, you know, they were solar powered. So it was sort of a limitation of charging up those batteries and not having dust accumulate on the solar panels and limit their lifespans. And that's actually the challenge that the InSight lander has faced, not being able to clear those dust panels. So in that line of lessons learned from sending missions to Mars, in order to power such an advanced instrument suite on Curiosity, and the same with Perseverance. Instead of solar panels, we actually use an RTG, so a radionuclide-powered energy source that charges up the batteries. So this means you have way more energy at the beginning of the mission, but the whole point is that the power source decays over time. That's how it generates energy. So you do eventually reach a point where you can't heat the you know, survival heaters. You can't, not only can you not do science, but you eventually just can't even move anymore. So there are finite lifespans to these missions, but a lot of it's based on modeling about how long we think we can go. We've become very efficient at using our batteries. And so I would say that, you know, Curiosity's prime mission was like a one Mars year, so two Earth years, and we've just hit 10 Earth years. So we've far exceeded our prime mission. We still have a lot in the tank to keep going. And so when will be the end? We don't quite know. But the really exciting news is that we still have a ton in the tank to keep exploring Gale Crater.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Are We There Yet? From 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Amy Williams, an assistant professor of geology at the University of Florida, about Curiosity. She's a member of the rover's science team, which is celebrating its 10th Earth year on Mars. Amy, Curiosity has another robotic explorer on Mars right now, Perseverance. We talked a little bit about this at the start of the conversation, but what lessons have we learned from Curiosity, and how are those being applied to this new rover and maybe the next rovers to come after Perseverance?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, Curiosity was the first time that we used the Skycrane landing system to land such a large vehicle on Mars. And you have to step back and think about how really terrifying it was for the science and engineering teams to watch the landing, because it's totally autonomous. It is all with the onboard computers, and it knows what it's supposed to do. And it had never been tried from start to finish before with Curiosity. The first time we tested the whole thing end to end was landing on Mars. And so, you know, of course, the system worked beautifully. We landed Curiosity, and we used the same system then to land Perseverance, you know, a decade later almost. And it is easy to say, yes, we've done this before, so we're good. So let's just land this rover and get moving. But you really have to step back and take into account the incredible engineering that went into building a delivery system like the Skycrane to land such a massive vehicle. So some of the things that have changed, especially with the landing system, is that we've actually been improving our ability to land with great precision. And so when Perseverance went to land on Mars, it actually had in its computer system on board the ability to look at the ground surface, compare with the maps in its database, and direct itself to land in a far more precise area than the abilities that Curiosity had. So it's really awesome to see how our precision landing is improving. And this will be useful, of course, with future landers and rovers and you know, presumably when we send humans to Mars, these kinds of technologies can be leveraged. So yeah, with the landing system, that was one of the big things. Like, that's the only way to deliver something this big to Mars.
When it comes to the science goals of Perseverance, is there any difference in what Curiosity is doing and what Perseverance is doing in terms of its scientific discovery? What's the difference between the two?
Yes, this is a really great way to sort of demonstrate the concept of standing on the shoulders of giants to accomplish your goals. So the MER rovers looked for evidence of water. Curiosity looked for evidence of habitable environments where life would want to live. And then Perseverance is actually looking for the rocks that could contain evidence for ancient life. So Perseverance is exploring Jezero Crater. It is collecting samples, not only analyzing samples on the surface, but its purpose is collecting samples for eventual return to Earth. And that is sort of the really big difference, in that, you know, we're planning to return a subset of these cores to Earth with the Mars sample return architecture. So we're not just identifying and characterizing environments on Mars just in situ, but performing some of those activities with Perseverance with the intent to return samples for us to then kind of marry both worlds of send the lab to Mars, but then bring the rocks back to our terrestrial labs to really ask those deep questions about whether there was life on Mars, how Earth and Mars diverge so much in their evolution as planets. All of these really profound and deep questions that we're just starting to scratch the surface of.
And those questions could not even be asked if it wasn't for the work of Curiosity, right?
Yes, these rovers, the landers, the missions that have come prior to these most recent flagship Mars missions, everything is always just building on the next step. And that's why you send a mission and then another mission, you know, 10 years later, right? Science is done in these steps. And this is one of the best ways to accomplish really extraordinary science.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there is a finite limit to these robotic explorers, but so far Curiosity has far exceeded its planned time on Mars. There's no signs of slowing. So what's ahead? What are some of the kind of scientific objectives as this mission moves into the next decade of discovery?
It's so exciting to think of, because I was on the mission as a grad student when we first launched. And so now being a professor at UF and having my own graduate students work on the mission with me is like really fulfilling to see us moving into this next decade in both professional and personal ways. So Curiosity has been exploring Gale Crater, which is it's a crater that formed from an impact from a space rock billions of years ago, and then filled in with sediments from lakes and rivers flowing into that crater. And so we've been slowly roving up the mountain in the middle of the crater, informally named Mount Sharp. And by doing this, we've been basically reading each layer of rock, sort of like pages in a book, where you can learn about the history of Mars from the rocks that we see in this sequence. And so we've been exploring these regions that were clearly formed by water. These were really habitable environments with rivers and lakes. And as we climb higher and higher, we're moving into a region that's far drier. And so we may be exploring sort of this major climatic shift on Mars, where we move from this wet, more hospitable world into this increasingly drier Mars. And so that's really the transition we're in now, moving up into what we call the sulfate bearing unit. So these rocks that tend to form when you have far more arid conditions. So those are the sort of the next most immediate steps for Curiosity in our exploration of Gale Crater.
We've been speaking with Amy Williams, an assistant professor of geology at the University of Florida and a member of the Curiosity rover science team, as well as Perseverance as well. But we're talking about Curiosity today. So
yeah, we are.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, with NASA's Artemis 1 mission less than 2 weeks away, the Space Coast is bracing for an influx of spectators hoping to catch a peek at the newest moon rocket. What to expect? That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From 90.7 WMFE News.
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. The launch of NASA's Artemis 1 mission is less than 2 weeks away, and the Space Coast is bracing for an influx of spectators. While this mission will carry no crew, it's still drumming up lots of interest as NASA launches the SLS rocket and Orion spacecraft for the first time. Emery Kelly reported on the potential tourism impact of this launch. He's a space reporter at Florida Today and joins us now. Emery, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brendan. Good to be back.
Good to have you. And Emery, I think it's accurate to say public interest in this Artemis 1 launch is quite high, but you did some reporting on some of the indicators that this is going to draw a big crowd at the Space Coast. What are these indicators?
Yes. Yeah, so first and foremost, it sounds like the tourism officials are definitely expecting, sold out businesses. In this case, several hotels, especially hotels that are as close to Kennedy Space Center as possible have sold out. There are companies that are supporting the launch, of course, that have in some cases booked up entire hotels, which makes sense, of course, for their people. But the tourism folks are also expecting somewhere between, well, at least 100,000 visitors to the Space Coast for this launch. And that includes folks coming from out of town, Orlando, you know, maybe counties north and south of us. But those folks will be clustered in a very tight area from Kennedy Space Center down to, we could say, Cocoa Beach, maybe. So that's a lot of people in a small area.
100,000, at least. That's quite a bit, Emery. But this is far from the only high-profile mission that's been hosted on the Space Coast. Can you give us some historical context? I mean, what have crowds been like in the past for you know, other big launches? And is the expectation that Artemis 1 will kind of meet that excitement?
Yeah, so the 100,000 number is absolutely on the very low end. That is more of a, I guess you could say, more of a minimum. It's hard to say with any certainty, of course, what it would be. And of course, you kind of approach it, those kind of numbers, conservatively. But during the SpaceX's first few missions to return astronauts back to the International Space Station since the shuttle was canceled in 2011, there were, for some of those, especially the first two crewed missions, and despite the fact it was COVID, there were north of 100,000 people for both of those first two missions. So it's pretty fair to say Artemis 1 will attract over 100,000. We'll see what the final number is for some historical perspective. You know, it's sort of been mentioned around our newsroom. I wasn't here for it, but when John Glenn went back to space on the space shuttle in his later years, that allegedly attracted somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people to the Space Coast, which at the time was a tripling of its population. So, you know, it's we're not probably not going to see numbers like 1 million or 750,000, but it would not surprise me to see a few 100,000 people here for Artemis 1. And this doesn't even include astronauts. So Artemis 2 with astronauts could be quite a bit more high profile, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make, is that, you know, this is uncrewed. It might not garner the same crowds as such as John Glenn or the final space shuttle flight. But I mean, it's still going to be a substantial crowd, 100,000 plus people. I mean, what are you hearing from tourism leaders and county officials about kind of preparations for all of these people that will be here?
Yeah, I mean, to a point, there's only so much you can do, I guess. By far the most popular place, if I had to guess, would be something like Jetty Park, right? The most you can do is kind of limit the number of cars that come in. And each place has its own sort of responsibilities on how full it can be. But because these crowds are going to be clustered in a small area to see this pretty big 322-foot rocket, it should make things kind of interesting, to say the least. During the SpaceX's first Falcon Heavy flight in 2018, there were folks, it took some folks 3 hours just to leave Port Canaveral after the launch. And that was, you know, that was 4 years ago. So now we have a bigger population. We have more interest in launches, and this is the launch everyone's been waiting for. So it'll be pretty packed.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Are We There Yet? From 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Emery Kelly. He's a space reporter at Florida Today about his reporting on the anticipated crowds here in Florida for the upcoming Artemis 1 launch. Emery, I was those people that were stuck in traffic after Falcon Heavy, as I'm sure you were as well. I mean, any advice for people who might be coming out and this is going to be their first event? I know, just be patient. What other advice may you have?
I think there's this misconception, or maybe not misconception, just it's not very well known. And especially with the size of this rocket, you do not have to be standing at one of the gates to Kennedy Space Center in order to see this thing, nor should you be there. Please don't do that. Please don't go up to the gate. But it's a big rocket. And I mean, even smaller rockets like SpaceX's Falcon 9, you can be as far south as Vero Beach, as far west as Tampa, you know, in Orlando, and still get some kind of view of it. So as long as you're coming to the Space Coast at all, it's okay if you're a few miles away, because you're already at least 10 to 12 miles away from the pad, no matter where you go, unless you have permission to be on Space Center property. So if you find, you know, somewhere a little bit more inland, like there's Cars Park, for example, or there are dozens of little parks like that, you're still going to get a fantastic view, and you're going to get all of the rumble and the sounds, and certainly wherever you are, there will be crowds as well.
Mm-hmm. And Emery, it's not just spectators, right? I mean, this is surely to bring a lot of news media, right? Reporters and producers are coming to the area. What have you found, speaking with Kennedy Space Center, about the media interest in this launch?
Yeah, so it sounds like the press site folks at Kennedy Space Center have limited this to 1,000 media, which is sort of from what I've heard, that's just a number for the most they can support. And it sounds like at least 700 media have signed on. You know, that's a huge number, obviously, but you know, it's further complicated by the fact that these folks also have to, if they're foreign nationals, right? If they're maybe an international broadcasting, you know, news outlet or something like that, then they need to have different types of escorts because they're not U.S. citizens. So it's a pretty complicated setup. And you know, easily at least 700 media will be at the press site for this one,
including you, right, Emery? Will you be out there covering?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I certainly plan on it.
We've been speaking with Emery Kelly. He's a space reporter at Florida Today and one of at least 700 reporters who will be covering Artemis. Emery, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's show, but more coverage of NASA's Artemis 1 mission is coming up in the coming weeks as we get closer and closer to T-minus zero from the Kennedy Space Center, including a conversation next week looking at the historical context of Artemis and what makes this different than our last attempt at going to the moon during the Apollo era of the 1960s and 1970s. Then join me for a conversation in collaboration with our friends and partners at WUCF-TV about the future of Artemis. We'll talk with a NASA engineer about lessons learned from this mission, a planetary scientist about how our understanding of the moon will get us to places like Mars, and someone from Space Florida who will help us understand the economic impact the Artemis program is having here in the Sunshine State. Don't miss any of those episodes. Tune in every week at 6:30 p.m. here on 90.7 WMFE News, or subscribe to the show's podcast feed. You can do that on NPR One, Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll also have all of our space coverage online at wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Editorial guidance this week from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. And until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.